This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And you know what? Do you think you can predict the winners of the 2024 elections? Well, with Interactive Brokers Forecast Trader, you can trade your forecast. Simply answer yes or no. Will Harris win the presidency? For example, on October 31st, 2024, the election probabilities on IBKR's trading platform were 58% for Trump and 42% for Harris. If you buy a yes contract for 42 cents on Harris and she wins, you get a dollar. If you think Trump is more likely to prevail, well, you could buy a yes contract on Trump for 58 cents. Or you could ask the question, for example, will the Democrats control the Senate and win? If you agree, buy a yes contract. If you disagree, buy a no contract. It's that easy. Prices range from 2 to 99 cents per contract. And correct predictions earn $1 at settlement, minus the contract costs, fees, and commissions, of course. And incorrect ones settle at zero. Furthermore, forecast contracts offer an incentive coupon, and the current rate is 4.33% APY. There's no better time to get started. The best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Visit IBKR.com/forecast and get started today. Interactive Brokers is a member SIPC.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets getting angry on mixed tech earnings. Employment report, well, it's a non-event. And, well, we're gearing up for the election. Our guest today is David Salem from Hedgeye. All this and much more on episode number 893 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz, and I'm in that big, comfy host chair in the new studios for the Disciplined Investor Podcast and for DH Unplugged, of course, where we do that each and every week on Tuesdays. Myself and John C. Dvorak spend some time together taking a look at all the news and information, the stocks that are moving, the economic numbers, the things that are really moving markets, and talk about that on a regular basis. But we do so in a much different style. If you have not spent any time listening to DH Unplugged, I highly recommend that you do so. You can find that, of course, on any podcast app out there. You know, just look up DH Unplugged, look up John C. Dvorak, look up Andrew Horowitz, whatever you want to do. But I think that's something that you want to do on a regular basis, because we have a lot of fun. We play a lot of games. We do some things that are quite funny. And I think you'd really enjoy that. Of course, you can find The Disciplined Investor. You can find DH Unplugged on any area, you know, any podcast app. Or go right to the sites, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. It's how you also get in touch with me. Let's talk about our guest today, because our guest is a really smart fellow. And we have a really great lineup of topics that we laid out, as we do each week. But these topics, I think, are going to be really, they're kind of high level, right? We're going to be talking about things related to, I have notes here, you know, lack of research, and how do you actually make a portfolio understandable, and how do you design it in a way that is made for the individual and the institution? So all of you investment advisors that are listening out there, you know, how do you actually create some of these high level portfolios, but at the same time, what mistakes to avoid? That's the big thing. So we're going to talk about that with David Salem from Hedgeye. Next week coming up, Tom Nelson. Tom Nelson, Senior VP, Head of Asset Allocation over at Franklin Templeton. He's going to be great as well, so I'm really looking forward to that. What's happening now? What is happening these days when it comes to the markets, the economy? Well, there's a lot of things that are really gyrating and moving around, but I think the front and center item that we're all talking about, depending on when you're listening to this. This is being put out right on the Sunday, a few days before the U.S. presidential election. Is what's the outcome? Who's going to be president? Who's going to control Congress? These are questions that a lot of people want to know. A lot of people think there's a incredible correlation potential for who is going to be president and what is going to happen with our economy, what is going to happen with markets. And I would say yes and no. There are four different possibilities that we really need to look at right now. The four possibilities that are going to really shape the next number of years when it comes to the economy and markets. And I got to say, a couple of them are the nothing burgers. The first thing we have is Trump president, Republican Congress. Trump president, Democratic Congress. Then we flip it over, Harris president, Democratic Congress. Harris president, Republican Congress. If we have a Trump president and a Democratic Congress, kind of the same thing as a Harris president and a Republican Congress, there's a lot of roadblock. There's a lot of, you know, just jamming up the system. Nothing happening, nothing getting done. There's a gridlock in Washington. The only difference is that a few of the things that former President Trump wants to do, he can do with executive order. Some of the things related to tariffs, which, you know, I am not a fan of tariffs. Am I a fan of free trade? Yes. Am I a fan of fair trade? Yes. The tariff is a tit-for-tat consumer inflation burden. It's a tit-for-tat with countries that if you impose a tariff on them, they'll impose a tariff on you. Impose a tariff. And what happens is, I don't care what anybody's saying, the reality is that you and I are paying the excess monies that are imposed as tariffs. Simple as that. I don't want to even get into a conversation about this because everything is just BS. There is nothing that we can say that any other country is paying for a tariff that we impose on their product, except for if you want to go with the idea that it is not good for sales of their products. So they're paying, not really paying in terms of the dollars. They're paying because they may have lower sales. The option to go elsewhere where there is no tariff, like Buy American, that makes a lot of sense. The truth of the matter is that though we may see the tariff on, let's pick something simple, a widget, the old widget, gets a lot of use. There's a 100% tariff on a widget that is imported from, let's say, China or somewhere else. What is going to happen to their American counterparts that sell widgets? You know what they're going to do? They're going to increase prices. I talk to my friends, colleagues. I talk to manufacturers. They all say, hey, when this tariffs, what we could do is we could raise our prices underneath the level of the tariff, still be competitive. But at the end of the day, what does that do? That raises prices that you and I are going to pay. Who is paying for the tariffs? We are. Yes, the tariffs go into the general income of the U.S. government, so that can offset some tax breaks that are given out here and there. But in the end, it is inflationary. And remember that the main issue that we're all dealing with right now is the burden of higher prices. We know that is the big issue, and tariffs are inflationary. But let's talk about some other things. Let's get past the idea of what's going on with the election. Let's talk about some of the economics for the most part. We know there's going to be volatility around this because emotions come into play. But okay, what else do we have? We have some other items on the menu, right? Let's agree that inflation is not coming down as fast as many would have hoped. But the silver lining we have is the economy is doing pretty well. The jobs numbers on Friday, well, we only added about 12,000 to the payrolls. I think we need to look past that. Let's not focus on that. And that's not usually what I would say. I would say the number's the number. Let's not try to make up stories. But here's some stories that we really need to impart into this discussion. It's part and parcel of what is happening right now with the employment number, because we still have, if you didn't notice behind the scenes, a 4.1% unemployment rate. Still very good. Relatively, it's not 3%, but it's still, you know, it's strong. A 4.1% unemployment rate is a pretty, that means 96% of the eligible employed people are working. Pretty good. but only 12,000. Oh my God, we're going into a recession. No, we have strikes, we have weather issues, and we have pre-election jitters by employers. So I'm not really going to focus on that. I don't think markets really focused on that either. We saw a mixed other economic numbers, but GDP came in pretty strong. Rates, the 10-year holding at the top of the range, about 4.25% on the 10-year. Oil getting a pretty significant bid. We saw that Iran on, was that Wednesday or Thursday of last week, vows to retaliate using proxies like Iran for the Israeli strikes. When is that going to happen? How is that going to happen? At what level? Is that going to expand the conflict to now another country? All the surrounding countries from Israel are pretty much honing in. And what does that mean for the U.S. jumping in and other allies jumping into the side of Israel? Really concerning issues. So generally, all the things we're talking about here add up to what? A big nothing. There's nothing different aside from the end of the presidential campaign cycle, which hopefully will end sharply at the right time on Tuesday. And whoever the outcome is and whatever we find to be whatever quadrant that is, the Republican House, Republican White House, Republican Congress, Republican White House, Democratic President, Republican Congress, or whatever the particular order of that is, will shake out and we'll figure out what we're going to be dealing with at that point. And the fact is, we did see, yes, a 2% correction again on Thursday as Meta. And we saw, for example, Microsoft disappointed. Did they really disappoint? Numbers were pretty good. Did Apple really disappoint? Yeah, the numbers were pretty good. I mean, we saw services at a major $100 billion business on Apple. We saw Amazon approaching all-time highs. AMD, we knew that was going to be a problem. We talk about that. That's a short position we have on the game over on DH Unplugged. Again, talking about that. The game that we talk about, our weekly game that we play of our stock picks. That is a pick that I put on some time ago. Because we know AMD is a different animal than NVIDIA. But the fact is that this 2% reduction we saw was because, well, stocks were priced to perfection. Any slip of margins of maybe free cash flow or possibly even spending or some other, nondescript issue underneath in a footnote was all set to send stocks down. Only took back what they probably made over the last couple of weeks, but there was a pretty sharp reduction. And what is that? The Pavlovian response to any kind of 2%. That's the new correction, by the way. 2%, not 5% is correction. 10% is major correction and 20% bear. It's like 2, 4, and 6 now. I mean, there's so much money sloshing around. There's so many people interested in seeing what's going on and the excitement over AI and technology and this next turning, if the fourth turning, if you will, again, of what we're going to see in the future, that people are pretty excited. A lot of short squeezes going on. Companies like Carvana. Have you seen that? Wow. Pretty impressive. And the crap earnings from Ford, especially compared to GM. So nothing really changed there. Nothing's really happening. Status quo. Big news is going to be next week. We'll have some discussion of that in the weeks to follow. But with that, we're going to bring on our guest and spend a little time talking about this long list of items I have, particularly things I want to get into about some of the governmental entities that are actually players in these markets these days. So let's get that on right now. And our guest today is David Salem. He's the Managing Director of Capital Allocation at HedgEye, which, as we've mentioned, I go back way back with HedgEye. So, David, first time on the show. Welcome.
My pleasure. Thank you, Andrew.
So let's start with a question I like to ask people and go back to how the hell do you get interested in the whole world of investing? Where to start? Where's the genesis of this?
That's a long story, but I'll make it very short. I sank into money management, as I like to say, immediately after finishing graduate school, and had the great good fortune to be employed initially at Grantham Mayo Van Otterloo, now known as GMO. So that was quite a really interesting immersion or baptism in our crazy industry. And from there, I was very fortunate to get some funding from the MacArthur Foundation to start what became known as the Investment Fund for Foundations, TIF. Did that for a good many years. I'm actually very proud of what we did there and happy to chat about it. And then more recently, I've been advising some very large scale investment programs. And that's what brought me here to HedgEye as a member of the team on the payroll, having been, like you, actually a client, a fee-paying client of HedgEye in Canada with my own nickels, in fact, for many years. And I sort of grew enamored with what was going on here, suggested to the powers that be here that they could adapt what I thought was a really ingenious system for higher turnover, shorter horizon investment programs, and adapt it to meet the needs of folks sitting in seats like the one I used to sit in, and to some extent still do, kind of overseeing a large-scale investment program.
So I'll stop there. Just for our listeners that have no idea what some of the things are that you mentioned, for example, you said the letters GMO. Just to be clear, that's not genetically modified organisms. Right?
No, I know what it is.
I mean, you got the big boy of, I mean, one of the most respected names in the industry is Jeremy Grantham.
Yes, and I had the great pleasure of spending countless hours sitting next to Jeremy, as I've said in another media. Jeremy absorbs information the way LBJ used to absorb information, by talking. So I had the great good fortune of sitting next to Jeremy for many hours at the GMO headquarters in Boston, listening to him talk and trying to telegraph through my own body language whether I thought what he was saying was sound or not. And I really almost never had the chance to inject any words edgewise, but it was great fun and in great training in the very early stages of my career.
Quite the gentleman, that fellow.
Yes, he is.
At least from what I've seen. You were up and close, maybe a different story. But and it's been relatively, you know, I don't want to focus on him, but just a point of reference. You know, he's been relatively, from what I can see, at least on the outside, I would say dour on markets for a while.
Yeah, we don't want to overgeneralize, because if you look at the way they're actually deploying capital, they are engaging in risk taking. It's just maybe not with the stuff that is, you know, front and center on mass media these days.
Yeah.
You know, the Mag 7 and the like, which you can talk about it on as you see fit. Yep. But I will say this while I have the floor on this, Andrew, that I'm a great admirer of Jeremy's, a great mentor of mine, and in some ways a personal hero because of his philanthropy, his generosity, his empathy. But I think actually, even at this point in his long career, but certainly when it's finished and we're looking back and grading it, I think it will be the case that on all the major inflection points, with the kind of imperfect timing that we always see in our business, Jeremy will be judged to have been generally correct. Hmm. And that's a pretty powerful claim.
That is, especially because there's so many inputs. Right. It's trying to understand all the things that are coming at us, whether it's from media, whether it's from actual sources, news sources, opinion. It's like trying to take a sip at out of an open water hydrant, you know, and it comes at us fast and furious, and trying then also to discern the voice within us. Am I right?
Yes, you're right about that. Although there's a great irony here. As you know, I'm sitting in HedgEye headquarters in Connecticut speaking to you, surrounded by people that collectively I have referred to as the greatest productivity hack I've ever encountered as a CIO. And let me just take, you know, 20 seconds to explain what I mean. It's precisely responsive to what you just said. We are swimming, drowning in a sea of, you know, a combo of noise and signal. A lot of Brownian motion for sure in financial markets. And, you know, job number 1, 2, and 3 for anyone sitting atop or overseeing or managing a large scale investment program, or frankly, you know, even a smaller portfolio, has to contend with the near impossible task of separating noise from signal and in doing it in a time and cost efficient manner. So that's how I came to, you know, HedgEye as a client and ultimately why I'm working here. Now, I don't want to focus unduly on HedgEye. I just want to agree with the premise that you put forth, you know, when you last spoke, and say, but there is a way to get to deal with it, I think, successfully, if you're really judicious about how you allocate your scarcest resource, which is actually not capital in the case of, you know, stewards of large scale investment programs. Their scarcest resource is, of course, time.
Yeah. That is.
Back to you.
So let's talk about some of the things that we have lined up to discuss. And I don't know, we could just go in the order, no particular order. So, you know, over the course of your career, and I look at this also, it's like, oh, I remember when I was tinkering around with neuro, which is probably called AI now, but neuro type of back testing and of modeling and very hardcore asset allocation based on modern portfolio theory and all these tools and techniques. And but a lot of things have changed over the years. What are the things that had worked for what you thought would work and kind of maybe even stopped using or maybe changed over the years?
Yeah, great question. Let me give you, and a fun question too. Let me give you a two-part answer. I'm kind of chuckling to myself because the first point of two that I'm going to make in response to your good question is that one of my, you know, lasting lessons from Jeremy Grantham is that he said to me early on in my tenure at GMO, look, David, take everything you learned at that fancy business school you went to. I want you to apply it rigorously here at GMO, but do so in reverse. Like, you know, traditional CAPM and modern portfolio theory says like the beta of a stock, its sensitivity to systematic changes, you know, is positively correlated with its long-term return. The higher the beta, the greater the long-term return. Actually, statistically, factually, that's incorrect. If you operate on the opposite premise, you know, give or take, you're better off. Okay, so that's part one of the answer to your good question. I don't know if you have a pushback on that.
So let's just kind of just delve into that for a second. So the theory is, I assume that the outcomes will be better because the markets in the long term are the one of the most, the best places to create capital. So therefore, a higher beta will effectually get you towards, under a long enough period of time, a reasonably better return, and the risk dissipates over the time. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Well, that is almost the academic definition of how it's supposed to work. But in practice, it actually, at least historically, has not worked that way. Just reverse the sign and it has worked, which is to say neglected lower beta stocks have over the long term compounded their shareholders' capital at a rate on average greater than that of high beta stocks. Hmm. Now, actually, if I can just do a quick sidebar here, we don't want to get too much in the weeds, but at kind of the mid or two-thirds point of my now, you know, multiple decade career, sort of academics and then almost instantly practitioners got wind of that very fact and started to arbit away by piling into low beta stocks, causing the very long-term historical tendency to itself reverse. So
isn't that always the case, though? Once you find something that is either works or doesn't work, and then somehow it get picked up, the whole thing gets ruined?
Typically, and that's how I can turn to part two of my answer to your good question. But before I do so explicitly, may say you're exactly right. Right, as I like to say, if you wait long enough for all the data to roll in, right, as a prudent fiduciary might otherwise be inclined to do, and the data points to a really great long-term opportunity in the rearview mirror, it's almost surely too late to do anything about it.
Right.
If I can say so.
I'm so right about this. No, you were right about this.
But I'm kind of digressing, but I hope in a way that you'll welcome, you and your audience. I think that, you know, the most conspicuous manifestation of this as we speak is, of course, private equity, where you have billions, almost trillions, literally, of dollars of dry powder waiting to be put to work by private equity managers who amassed or accumulated those commitments from their generally institutional limited partners because those institutions were looking in the rearview mirror in 2017, 18, 19, 20, right through 21, saying private equity and the subset of it called venture capital is a superior way to compound wealth. I think I'll pile billions into it. And they all did so, you know, generating a great example of what we call, of course, the fallacy of composition. If you and I decide, oh, we're going to sneak through that, you know, the exit door of the crowded theater, it's great if there's just one or two of us try to get through it. But if everybody tries to get through it at the same time, fallacy of composition, they won't achieve their stated aims. And that's been the case with private equity here quite recently. We can go back through the history of institutional investing back to the dawn of my career and identify numerous instances where what I've just described has happened, to the great lament and regret of the people moving money in the direction of what they thought were going to be very, very, you know, plentiful pastures based on rearview mirror thinking.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've looked recently at some portfolios that have come through here with gobs of positions in private equity and hedge funds and alts, but I'm not talking about I'm talking about straight up, like right in there. Like, and the managers seem to believe that they can manage this totality of all of these individuals as if they were index funds and utilizing them as a asset allocation. You follow what I'm saying here? And I'm like, how the hell? Seriously. I'm like, how do you have, and they even have a list of these are on the watch list. These are going to be, I'm thinking, first of all, you tell me what you think about this. You're investing in private equity. Do you really know what the valuation is of that portfolio at any given time? Unless you're the last guy to get out when the whole thing, you know, eventually closes. Maybe it could be very good. I mean, the valuation models of private equity is an entirely different model than a capital markets where it is openly traded on a regular basis, right? Would you agree with that?
Completely.
Yeah. So now all of a sudden you have this gobs of this mark, quote unquote, mark to market investment within a portfolio. Let's just kind of make this up. Let's say there's 10 different private equity positions you have from these, you know, firms, your high net worth client, and you're trying to, as an advisor overseeing this, look at this and then listen to what? What are you listening to? You're listening to the quarterly, the monthly calls and spreadsheets and the commentary, which, what are they going to do? They're going to make it all look, you know, good. And of course, hold on the books the valuations that seem to be reasonable, side pocket the rest. I'll stop there. Commentary on that?
Yeah, no, I think generally speaking, one of my great lessons I've learned through the course of my career is the danger of overgeneralization about anything having to do with markets or finance or the economy. That said, however, I generally do agree with your generalization.
Yeah.
That is what's going on. There's actually another great irony here, because you mentioned or hinted earlier that you're a hedge eye client, hence subscriber. And so it's now, 2:15 Eastern time. And by tomorrow morning, forgive me, but I have to deliver tomorrow's early look to hedge eye clients worldwide. Mm-hmm. And this is the topic that I'm writing about, because it's already, you know, I only have 12 hours to finish the darn thing from now. So it's already 2/3 finished. And this is exactly the issue that I'm exploring. The suspect valuations, and quite seriously, Andrew, and very importantly in the context, and most of my career has been spent, very fortunately for me, and gratifyingly, advising endowments, foundations, and sort of some other sort of not-for-profit actors that mm-hmm. have accumulated a lot of wealth, big mm-hmm. universities and foundations and the like. It's really rewarding work. But most of them, either because it's statutorily mandated, as with private foundations like Rockefeller and MacArthur, or because they know of prudence that they have to adopt a sensible spending and withdrawal formula, like a big college or university endowment, you know, they sort of migrate towards 5% of a sensibly computed denominator. And that's the key point I'm driving at, which is the sensibly computed denominator is typically, I think for prudential reasons, sensibly, it's like a 12-quarter moving average of the pot of money's value. Well, what do you do when you have 35, 40, 45% illiquid private, and you just know, if you're being honest with yourself and others sitting around the table, that the marks on those things are highly suspect. But the application of the spending formula, we'll call it for simplicity's sake, 5%. Let's imagine it's an institution with a $10 billion endowment. Right? You can do the math, right? 5% of 10 billion. Okay, we can withdraw that much. Mm-hmm. You know, that $500 million a year and transfer it over to the budget, which some institutions do. But wait a minute, what if it's not actually worth $10 billion, right? What if it's worth like 8 or 7, right? But we won't know that for several years when all the dust settles.
That's like drilling on a tooth that seems fine, and all of a sudden there's a cavity in there somewhere.
Exactly. That's a good analogy. Yeah. But, you know, yeah, exactly. You wake up 3, 4, 5 years later, and you say, wait a minute, we have dramatically overspent.
Well, right? I'm going to give you another analogy that you can use. If you're going to be writing about this, I'm going to give this to you. It's the sinkhole effect. Basically, you have a road that looks very solid to be driving over just fine. But underneath all of that is actually a river that is eroding the underbelly of that. And one day, that top layer just can't hold. Or maybe you actually decided that that's an area that you need to be chipping out. And you didn't realize that there's nothing underneath that. So if you want to use that for your piece on this item for valuation question, I've used that many times. I created that, the sinkhole effect.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Let me just extend that thought, if you don't mind, for a minute or two. Mm-hmm. I'll use the same analogy, right? That image, you're driving down the road and there's maybe, and in your example, there will be, and there is a sinkhole. The question, the meta question we have to ask is, why did they drive down that road to begin with? Did they need to? Right. Was it the only way to get from point A to point B and they needed to get to point B? That's seldom, if ever, the case. For a fully globalized, what we call around here, as you surely know, we call it a go anywhere, but don't go everywhere mm-hmm. approach to investing.
Right.
And,
right.
And that's really the, and this is where I would make the argument. You know, this is coming from somebody, as you know, I was for many years the founding CEO and CIO at the Investment Fund for Foundations. And from, you know, a starting base of $0 under management and no employees, when I left almost 20 years later, we were something like $9 billion. And the point I'm driving at is that more than half of that, the asset base, the AUM, and the fee generating, you know, assets under management were tied up one form or another in private or liquid strategies. So I know not only have a lot of experience contending with them, but you would say, you know, for most of my career, I certainly don't have a bias against them. That said, I've actually never encountered, an ultimate asset owner, the board of trustees of Endowment Foundation, the overseers of a sovereign wealth fund, a big family office. I've never encountered one who articulated aims, ultimate aims of compounding wealth that I didn't believe could be achieved through the exclusive deployment of capital among marketable as distinct from private securities.
Yeah, it puts the hair on the back of my neck up a little bit when I see a portfolio come in, and there may be good reason that but that it seems like, again, they're trading around private equity positions or hedge fund positions, or it's like, wait a minute, can somebody really tell me what's going on inside all of these? And like you said, are there other roads to actually get there that could be the equivalent? Let's hold on that for a second. We'll go to a quick break, come back. I want to talk about some of the mistakes. We're talking about institutional investors. I want to talk about some of the mistakes that individual investors are making, because I do believe, by the way, I'm gonna hold you to answer this right after this, but I do believe that even though we try to have, investment committees, or let's just bring it down to the individual that wants to believe they understand what is happening within their portfolios, a lot of things are like just, oh God, I just hope that works out well. You know, I think it should work. We're doing our work on this, but, and it has worked. Everybody else is doing it. So, okay, we'll go along with that. Hang on to that for 1 second. And let's spend a moment talking about Interactive Brokers again, because Interactive Brokers has key competitive advantages for sophisticated investors like you. IBKR's margin loan rates are from just 5.33% to 6.33%. rated among the lowest margin fees by stockbrokers.com. Compare IBKR's low margin borrowing cost to other brokers, and you're going to find out that they charge hundreds of basis points more. Of course, you know that rates are subject to change, but margin is only for the experienced investors with a high risk tolerance. And in fact, you know that when you're on margin, you may lose more than your initial investment. But I want you to check it out, because the best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Go to IBKR.com/compare. All right, we're back with David Salem, Managing Director, Capital Allocation at HedgeEye. And we left off with a question about mistakes that institutional investors and individuals make from all these different things. And I think, I guess I'll just throw it to you, that what do you see out there that are the most blatant mistakes that really are being made?
Yeah, I'll say blatant, common, and avoidable.
Yeah.
So why don't I just roll quickly with a couple, and you just jump in, Andrew, if you want me to go in a different direction.
Yep.
You know, the most common by far, and it's certainly avoidable, is people that try to serve multiple masters equally, Right? I mean, there's a line in the Bible about that. Don't do that. Mm-hmm. And in this context, it means that you have failed to rank order your pursuit of absolute or relative returns. Relative can be a benchmark like the S&P or a peer group in the case of a big university endowment. But you need to specify in rank order because they will come into conflict, right? I mean, I've lived and breathed this in my career, 1999 for sure, and even 2007 to some extent, late 2006, where, you know, prudence in my view as a CIO dictated that we back off assets that were climbing ever higher in valuation out of prudence. Right. But of course, the relative returns started to dip and people started to lose confidence in you. We saw this massively with Warren Buffett and Berkshire in 1999, a year I already alluded to. So trying to serve multiple masters equally is a path towards, you know, wreck and ruin in investing. Next on my list is kind of people tend to waste time getting to know, N-O, not K-N-O, but by getting to know, of course, I mean, do enough due diligence where you can look at something and say, you know, that doesn't meet my needs. I need to move on. And I see way too many investors spending way too much time doing semi-deep or deep dives into things that right up front they could have concluded weren't going to meet their needs. Another mistake I see that's common, blatant, and avoidable, mistaking marketing schemes for asset classes. Some of my favorites historically, you know, when O'Neill on behalf of Goldman was saying, put your money in the BRICS, right? Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. Those countries, if you really thought about them for 10 minutes, they actually had nothing in common in terms of fundamental risk drivers. They made no sense whatsoever.
Well, but it named sort of, a nice acronym.
Well, for marketing schemes. Yeah. It was more of a marketing scheme. Right. I would actually argue to you today, I mean, certainly ESG is today's poster, or maybe last year's poster child for a marketing scheme masquerading as an asset class, but infrastructure too, I would argue. I got a few more, Andrew, but you want me to just press on?
No, I think it's fascinating, by the way. You talk about, you know, the BRICS and people, obviously, the BRICS are really BICS now. It's very difficult as a U.S. investor, an average U.S. investor, impossible to invest in Russia. So the BICS, yeah. BRICS have turned into BICS, which is, just to be clear, Brazil, well, the old ones, Brazil, Russia, India, what did I miss?
China and South Africa.
China and South Africa, yeah. So, and those were the... we'll go with emerging slash maybe frontier on the South Africa side, those nations. And that was this kind of like, hey, let's just group those together and create ETFs, mutual funds and all this stuff. And the reasons, rationale, and the reams of paper that were printed to prove the point after the marketing team got done, right?
That's a good way of putting it.
Right?
That's a good way of putting it, yeah.
Continue on with some of these mistakes, but yeah. You know, in terms of, I think the one thing also is assumption, right? Assumption that everything will be fine. Everything will be, that's very general, but that the Fed has our back, that the markets always go up, that, you know, that the management will take care of things, that a company like Boeing nobody will let it go. They're too big to fail. These are like these baseline assumptions that we all have. Well, we have to have some that we live by when we invest, right?
Yeah. So that actually brings me back to part two of the good question you posed, you know, 5 or so minutes earlier, and it brings me to a quick comment, at least a quick comment, and you can ask me to elaborate if you want to double click. On what's really fundamentally changed in markets and in the, you know, the conscientious stewardship of large scale investment programs over the course of my career. And what I'm driving at, of course, is the very forces and factors that you just cataloged. You know, where are we with the Fed, right? Is there a Fed put? To what extent, as my friend Ben Hunt likes to say, have we let authorities convert capital markets into essentially political utilities? And that is not a partisan statement, right? I'm not going to get into my own politics here. It's a bipartisan or rather nonpartisan statement, but there's a really important corollary. And it's one that I think many investment professionals who, like me, you know, cut their teeth many years ago and have stayed at it, kept our, you know, large noses to the grindstone ever since. We really lament the fact that for many years now, at least a half dozen, maybe going right back to 2009, flows, have dominated fundamentals, due in part, if not large part, to the active intervention of governmental actors in what would otherwise be a freer market pricing of securities and the cost of capital. And that has made life punishingly difficult for many investment professionals to the point where, and I know you would agree, Andrew, that many of them, very competent, very skilled, and certainly very experienced, have just left the industry.
Yeah, they've
hung up their cleats because they said, I don't know what to do about this. Now, without, you know, engaging in excessively shameless promotion about what goes on here in HedgeEye, this was the principal reason that for many years, I opened my own wallet and paid HedgeEye a lot of my own personal money to help me understand and exploit rather than being exploited by these flows. I'll stop right there. You can ask
now, it's really interesting about the flow discussion, because anytime somebody brings this up, the concept that a listener, I think, has is, well, yes, the central banks are creating, you know, taking rates down. They're providing stimulus. They're doing things like, you know, central bank, I would call it buybacks, but on another way to look at it is quantitative easing, right? But what's really interesting, I did some research last week on DH Unplugged, another show that we do. The actual intervention that people don't recognize of direct investment in equity markets. Japan does it outright, and they tell you they do it in their own markets. I think there's something like 70% of Japanese market is owned by ETFs are owned by Japan. It's something, some crazy number. But you have the Bank of Norway, you have Switzerland, you have probably 6 or 7 different central banks that are actively involved in buying bukus. There was last week, Sweden, I think it was, NVIDIA, they upped their NVIDIA stake. They have, that's big money. That's big money that is unlimited. And I think that's a pretty interesting point right there that has to go into our conversation about what central banks and government actors are actually doing. Don't you think?
I do. 2 comments in response to what you just said. The first is rather obvious, but I think, you know, one of us should underscore it during this conversation. So I'll do so briefly right now. The real problem with all of that, and you're right, BOJ, that's the Bank of Japan, the Bank of Swiss National Bank, SNB, et cetera, it's a pretty long list. The key point is that they are non-economic actors. So when they're buying and selling, they are not principally thinking about return generation or capital preservation. Consequently, they are likely, not certain, but likely to become accomplices to the crime of mispricing capital. Mm-hmm. That's just not a good thing for society and the world. That's what I meant when I said unoriginally, that's the conversion of capital markets into political utilities. But let me mention something else that's sort of a first cousin once removed of that, bringing us back to the USA, right? The fact is that a lot of the flow, the systematically driven flows, both buying and selling, and these days it tends to be more buying than selling and has been for several years, is animated and catalyzed by governmental regulations, particularly as applied to 401ks, mm-hmm. 403bs, what you and I would call defined contribution pension schemes, where you have a safe harbor. I know you know this intimately, and I'm surely better than I do, Andrew. Mm-hmm. Safe harbors that the government says, Andrew, if you're managing, you know, 401k money and you put it essentially into a target date fund or 60-40, 70-30 construct, you're going to be fine. You'll never get sued and we'll never come after you for imprudence.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that has created an enormous continuous flow. What others, you know, that have experience in the trading desk would be a bid under the price of securities that meet that profile. And that would be particularly, of course, the cap-weighted S&P 500 and U.S. Treasury bonds.
So one of the things I've talked about and I named as a construct is, when people ask me why the market's going up, what's happening, I call it the mechanics of the market. The fact that everyone that is working is getting paid every single week, but more so the markets are getting paid every single week because the money that you're being paid, part of it's being sliced off and sent over to your 401k provider, automatically put into what, whether it's a target date fund like you mentioned, or something else that is somehow involved in equity markets. And the fact is that is a mechanical process that goes on every single week of the year infinitum. And because we don't have defined benefit plans anymore, right? We don't have real pension plans anymore. We're responsible for all that. And therefore, we have to keep putting money in. The only time that's going to see any kind of hiccup, if there's any significant mass employment situation, that could have a real problem because no longer is that person being paid, not putting money into their 401k. But mechanics, I see it like a steam engine. It just keeps on rolling in, keeps on rolling in. It's a wonderful pension for Fidelity, the number one pension 401k provider in the world. It's their pension. It's a pension on a pension.
Yeah. It's an annuity, a form of an annuity for the Johnson family.
Exactly. It's a wonderful thing.
And I know many of those people. I like them. Some of them are clients of Hedgeye. So I don't want to be overly critical. But truly, they're trying to do the best they can under boundary conditions that from a society-wide point of view are suboptimal, in my opinion.
I agree with that.
So that's the point we're driving at. Yeah, it's very unfortunate.
Let's switch over to something into a total left turn, shall we? Let's talk about China. You're Nick. You've been to China? Have you been to China?
Yes, extensively.
Yeah, I've been to China. Yeah. I love China, by the way. I do. I really do love China. Well, I love China when I went. I don't know if I'd love it today, but I did love China going up and down into the various cities, north, south. Culture, just the food, just the whole vibe. Just it's so much different than here, right? It's so much different than here. But you are, as you would say, a perma bear on China, and very bullish on Japan. And you know, it's funny. I really like China. I like some of the things they've done over the years. And I'm talking about markets now. Japan, I'm just so aggravated with Japan. It just with the negative interest rates and with the what they've done and how I see them manipulating markets and constantly manipulating the currency, which they, you know, of course they're not a currency. We'll never take that envelope out of the pocket, right, of the treasurer to give it to Japan and say you're a currency manipulator. But we know what they do. It's very clear. You could see it at 8 p.m. at night or so when currency markets reopen and Japan comes on for business. They take the yen down, and they've been taking it down for a while. Tell us why you have these, not necessarily polar opposite, but these differing opinions on China versus Japan.
Good. I'll do that real quickly here. I mean, obviously my time is yours, but just to be concise in the interest of brevity. So on China, first is kind of a subjective comment, although I secretly kind of think it's objective, and then an objective one rooted in professional portfolio management. The sort of subjective comment is simply that I find it extremely depressing to be in China. Yes, of course, the food is great, some of the engineering marvels, the list goes on and on and on. But the fundamental core reason why I find it depressing is because I look around and I realize these people do not have and are not likely to ever have in their lifetimes the kind of freedoms and liberties that we enjoy. And I find that overwhelmingly depressing, right? It just violates my very soul, okay?
I get that. I totally get that, by the way.
That relates to the second part, the objective reason why I think it's just per se imprudent to commit capital of any kind, but particularly long horizon capital, to securities of companies that are domiciled in China. So I want to be precise in my language. Right. Although I could point to what are called the VIEs, I'm sure you're familiar with them, the variable interest entities, they're often in the Cayman Islands, that purportedly give you exposure to major Chinese companies. But the key reason I'm driving at is very simply stated. There's so much dominance of the government in the economy that you don't have the assurance that on some day, probably not announced in advance, you will wake up and all of the capital you have deployed in China domiciled companies will have either been taken away or have essentially gone to zero. And of course, we do have a recent example of that immediately following Russia's second invasion of Ukraine in 2022, the first one having come in 2014. So then what do you do as an investment professional if, as you think about the full range of plausible outcomes, Andrew, and you look at the left tail and you say, wait a minute, there's a worrisomely high probability this is going to go to zero. It doesn't mean you don't do it, right? I mean, the whole venture capital industry is based on the idea.
Exactly that. That's exactly it. Right, right. A binary outcome.
It's going to be a fat left tail, yeah, right? Yeah. We get that.
Yeah.
The point is, do you have a sufficiently high expected return, the so-called right side of the tail, that's commensurate with the risk you're taking because of the plump probabilities at the left side of the distribution, which are the losses? And that's the key core argument I make against having a big scale investment program commit capital to China. And I have maintained this position through the entirety of my career, going back, predating China's admission to the WTO in 2000, which I think was one of the greatest policy errors this country has ever committed. Now, let me just stop there before I go over to Japan. You want to discuss China further?
I get it. I mean, you have obviously a lot of state-run enterprises, and obviously, they're holding up a lot of things. We know that what's going on with their real estate market is just disastrous. I personally, if you haven't seen it, I'm telling you, and my listeners have heard me talk about this. Back in the day when they were talking about ghost cities, I witnessed this. 50 miles I drove, and the whole time my mouth opened wide going, oh, my God. Of empty buildings after buildings after buildings that were just not going to be completed, nor ever would be completed, and were just put up just to be put up. And we know that, from satellite imagery, but I'm telling you, I was there. It was weird. And we know that also the banks are being held up by the government. And at the same time, taking another discussion, we've seen basically panel vanned, black bag over the head kind of a CEO... kidnappings, right? I mean, that's exactly what happened, I guess. Put up into hotels and that were at least reasonable and forced to pretty much disgorge money back to the government.
Yes. And I've been the beneficiary of some private conversations with a gentleman. We're doing an increasing amount of work here at Hedgeye. His name is Dennis Kwok, and he's a former member of the Hong Kong Legislature, Parliament, now living here in New England. For reasons that are germane to the comments you just made.
Yeah, no panel fans and no blackhead.
So what you've seen publicly and visibly, Andrew, is lamentably, sadly, only the tip of the iceberg, a very ugly iceberg of what actually goes on. And this isn't some big time conspiracy theory. You know, I just think this is a sober, objective assessment of the risks. Again, I'm perfectly prepared. I have a lot of experience, ongoing experience in venture investing. I fully expect some of the holdings that I'm financing to go to zero, right? The question is, do you have upside that's commensurate with those acute risks? Yeah. In the case of China, I don't think you do.
Yeah. So what about Japan? What is it that you like about Japan? Because, we could point to aging population. We could talk to government intervention that just really without it, it's going to collapse. We could talk about a yen that's going to nowhere. We could talk about deflation that's not going to stop. Shall I go on? Or how about you just cut me off and tell me what you like about it?
I'm happy to cut you off with a smile and a chuckle. And I think hopefully, again, in the interest of being very concise, my concerns and animus toward China are top down. My bullishness on Japan is bottom up.
Okay.
So all of the factors, demographic, monetary policy, an often malfunctioning, dysfunctional government, it's a very long list, right? Which I would argue, I suspect you might agree, but perhaps not, is already reflected in security prices. The bottom-up opportunity is sort of company by company, one by one, with the probable permanent exclusion of a lot of big multinational companies that I would never invest in Japan, right? But small, as we say here, SMIDs, right? Small and mid-caps that are undervalued, that are under increasing pressure to get their share prices above their book values. And for a whole host of other reasons, including importantly, because this is quasi-demographics, last point, and I'll turn it back to you, you actually do have a passing of the baton in many of these companies where very elderly management is passing the baton of leadership and management to younger generations that are hungrier, energetic. They wouldn't think of leaving Japan for perceived greener pastures. They're going to stay the course, and they will over time, and maybe I can say this is the key point, right? They will generate, I believe, shareholder returns that are commensurate with the very minimal risks that I perceive on a bottom-up basis by investments in companies like the ones I'm describing.
Mm, interesting. Right?
Yeah. It's almost the mirror image of China. It's also, if I can just interject, Andrew, in a crucially important geopolitical and military sense, Japan and China are exact opposites of each other from the viewpoint of a patriotic American. We desperately need the alliance with Japan for geographic, for literally, you know, supply side, supply chain, ship repair reasons. I think we also need them. There are certain, you know, forms of machining and machining of machine tools, to be very specific, that can only go on in Japan. And we really need them. And they have proven.
Well, just let's say this. Can I say this?
Go ahead.
Have you ever used a Chinese knife in the kitchen versus a Japanese knife in the kitchen? That's what you're saying. Right? Total different in the quality of the material.
Yeah, I don't do much of that, but I'll take it on.
No. Well, it's the same thing. It's a Chinese product versus a Japanese product. You know, I mean, there's a whole different thing. And by the way, I think there's something to be said about the low interest rates, et cetera, in Japan. But I'm with you on that. I mean, I get it. There is definitely
what
something.
What do they do? If I can just come back at you, I'm sincerely interested in your answer to the question. What do you make of the fact that the BOJ is at least trying to normalize interest rates?
I mean, I think that's a fascinating thing. It's going to be very difficult for them because it's been so deep-rooted. For how many years has it been that they have, you know, ridiculously low interest rates? And that had to do with, obviously, a lot of things about their the economics of the country, the demographics about the country, and just where they were. I mean, I think it's a bold and beneficial opportunity. We had that little yen blip after they started, you know, what, 2 months ago, 3 months ago, whatever it was. Things got a little crazy with the carry trade, but that's not their fault necessarily per se. Although they've, you know, been behind with backing the fact that the yen shouldn't be as low, but it is. I mean, I think it's an interesting process. I don't know how far they're going to be able to get, to be honest with you.
Yeah. That was August 5th that you're alluding to, a memorable day in my career.
Yeah.
But if we just want to roll the clock back just a bit further, because when I landed at GMO at the start of my career in money management, right, GMO was already managing a lot of international equity money against what was called the IFA benchmark, mm-hmm. which was Europe, Australia, and the Far East, of which Japan comprised, the day my GMO career started, roughly 70% of that global ex-US index, mm-hmm. 70. Right. You want to guess what GMO's actual weight was in the portfolios on that date?
I have no idea.
Zero.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
A career defining and potentially career ending bet, right? Which for the 3 years or so before I arrived at GMO, almost put the firm out of business, right?
Yeah.
And the reason I'm pointing to this, I don't want to get too in the weeds, but whenever you get an extraordinary outcome, in my experience, based on study of history, it's always tautologically the result of a confluence of extraordinary events, plural. In the case of Japan, you got one of the most prolonged bear markets in the history of marketable securities investing, which started on the first business day of 1990. Why had Japan gone up so much, so fast in the 1980s? It was because of what's called cross-holdings, right? Which for a whole bunch of reasons going beyond the scope of this pod, caused that upward self-reinforcing reflexive cycle of ever-rising valuations. It took many, many years for that to sort of boil off. But we're at that point right now, not completely, but substantially. And it's really important to recognize the change in corporate governance and in capital allocation that has resulted and will continue to unfold as a result of there's not a de jure or legal ban on cross holdings, but there's now as strong a cultural imperative against them as there was a cultural imperative in favor of them, as the Japanese market was reflexively moving higher in the 1980s.
I want to kind of stay on the subject of central bank concept and governments and some of the things that are going on. We know that your firm's outlook on inflation is that it's not going to be as cool as the Fed is thinking it's going to be, right? The interesting thing is that we've been hearing from the Fed and the Fed speakers that I call it the March of the Wooden Soldiers, you know, coming out and all talking about the same thing, trying to jam it up. But, you know, interesting, last week or so, there was a former Fed governor, Kevin Warsh, who came out and he discussed the Federal Reserve's policy. he broke his from ranks. You never see this, I don't think. You know, you once you're in the Fed, you're, you know, it's always the secret society of the Fed, right? The wink and the handshake and the gentlemanly agreement that, hey, we're not going to talk badly about stuff and we're going to stay on the same page. He actually came out and talked about the puzzlement over the Fed's 50 basis point cut, arguing that it contradicts their previous statements about policy. He criticized the Fed for not having a clear theory of inflation not being data dependent. He also mentioned the Fed's shift in focus from core PCE to core services, excluding housing, and now then the importance of wages. And they're all over the place. I've been a Fed, I don't want to say anti-Fed, that's not the right way to say it, but just a perplexed at why everybody is so behind everything and realizing that years ago, they're just cheerleaders. Okay. And I thought that inflation was, this was a bad move, this 50 basis point move. I'm going to stop there. Bring you in now. Okay, so what do you think?
If you only gave me like fewer than 10 seconds to respond, I would say they are manifestly and unfortunately making it up as they go.
Yeah.
Full stop.
right.
Now, but that's, you know, that addresses kind of or raises an open question, like what's wrong with making it up as you go? And there are a lot of things that are wrong with making it up as you go, when you have dominant control over the most important price in any economy, right? Which is the price of money,
right?
Because everything else is rooted in it. So yeah, I'm aware of what Mr. Warsh said. We could argue that he's the exception that proves the rule. I actually would dispute with you just, you know, almost for the entertainment value of it, but seriously, I actually don't think the culture is as sort of suffocating as many outside observers think or surmise. I actually think it's something a little bit different and subtle. It just attracts people who are comfortable in an environment of groupthink. And it, further, if I can be even more critical, right? That's not universally true. Obviously, we have Kevin Warsh. We had Dick Fisher running the Dallas Fed for some years, who was an further exception that proved that rule, right? But I marvel, truly, Andrew, I almost cannot believe when I hear both Fed officials and like respected Fed watchers, getting back to the original main thread here, which is our still above consensus view of pending inflation, right? I cannot believe the degree to which they are either consciously or maybe worse, subconsciously or unconsciously ignoring all important base effects in their thinking about inflation. Now, what is inflation, right? Inflation can be mathematically computed. It's this price against the price of a good or service at some point in the past. And you divide the one by the other and you get a ratio, and that's your rate of inflation. But it's obvious if you do that math, right, which any sixth grader can do, it's simple algebra, right, that the denominator is important. That's called a base effect in this context, right? So when we do extremely careful study of base effects, which is one of the hallmarks of what goes on here at HedgeEye, either in our macro work or, you know, we have, you know, teams of analysts looking at individual companies and using base effect thinking to think about acceleration or deceleration in their sales, in their profit, in their operating cash flows. That's at the company basis. Well, you can do that at the society-wide or macro level as well. And when you do that, and I think it, in these days, it takes like 20 minutes to look at the rearview mirror carefully and say, how plausible is it that inflation is going to reach the Fed's much discussed target of 2% or anything close to it as we move through the current quarter and into 2025, we'll say through maybe the middle of 2025, which is about as far as I speak right now as our models can go with a high degree of confidence that they're going to be accurate. And what they're telegraphing to us, based on careful consideration of base effects and, of course, other variables, is that inflation, at least in the foreseeable future, measured by CPI headline, has bottomed and is going up. It's not going to 7 or 8 or 9. We'll call it mid threes. And I think actually in the last few weeks, I don't want to date this podcast unduly, but the market has started sort of moving.
Yeah, no, clearly.
HedgeEye's point of view.
Clearly.
The curve is shifting in a manner. Yeah, I mean, look what's happened to rates all the way across the curve.
So you talk about this Bayesian inference. Now, is that Is that the equivalent of looking at a moving average, standard moving average, right? Just a basic moving average where you just take the latest day and divide it by the last 50, for example, versus a weighted moving average where you take a weighting of the most recent data as a more much more important aspect of the information. Is that what that means?
Yeah, I think the second way is a pretty good way of describing it. Yeah. I mean, you can be even more general and say, what is Bayesian inference? Big, 25-cent words. It's just simply just when you're making judgments or doing analyses, why don't you just use the best available data?
That's what I'm saying. As long as you're using the right data, as long as you're not flipping around and changing the numbers and doing like the Jerry Lewis movie, don't raise the bridge, lower the water. Right. Yeah. And where we have a situation where we're going to say, OK, you know what, let's change the definition and statistical calculation of inflation so that we can, which they did, by the way, last year, and they've done over the years. As long as we keep a standardized level of some of this so we understand what our goalposts are, I think that's a basic principle.
Yeah, and I have an immediate comment to that one I never tire of making, because I actually think immodestly it's actually quite important for us as citizens and voters. And it, hopefully everything I've said here, is non-partisan but politically charged. I said earlier when you said, David, what are these mistakes that people tend to make? They're blatant, common, and avoidable. And I said, well, number one on the list, no close second, is trying to serve multiple masters equally. What's the germaneness of that to our discussion right now of the Fed? Here it is. Who oversees and gave Fed the mandate? Congress. What did it do when it gave Fed mandate, which was most recently revised in 1978 through the Humphrey-Hawkins Act, which I'm sure you're familiar with? It said, okay, your mandate is threefold, right? It is stable prices, maximum employment, and literally in the statute, moderate interest rates. They never rank ordered the three. They did not specify a time horizon over which they shall be measured by the Fed in pursuit of this wholly unworkable, incoherent mandate. So it's not entirely the Fed's fault, although I will be critical of certain people that have worked for the Fed, because I think they've displayed, Andrew, basically an ethical failing. They're taking good money for their good work for the Fed, but not putting their hands up and saying to Congress, forgive me, with all due respect, the mandate you've given us makes no sense whatsoever. It is not serving America or our citizens well. You can do better, and you must. And that's where we are.
Sad as you see the things that are in China, that's just as sad as here. That's not going to change either. That one point, I think that it's in a way, maybe unintentionally, but intentionally now done to create the aspect of do whatever needs to be done and keep it so confused and confounding people that nobody exactly can put their finger on the moving target of what they're doing and why they're doing it. So just as a
I can't disagree or dispute what you just said. I think I'm more optimistic, maybe even much more optimistic than you are, about the potential for reform and its timing. It's not going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen, in the next year or so. But sooner rather than later, I think that swamp, if you will get drained.
That's great. David Salem, Managing Director, Capital Allocation at Hedgeye. A fascinating discussion, by the way. We have to do this again sooner. I'm surprised all these years. We've been doing this for a long time. This is episode number 893. This is going on since 07, I think it is. So we're going to have you on again soon. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Andrew. Enjoyed it.
And this is going to wrap up another episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me this week. Looking forward to next week and the next few weeks with some great guests. Brian Shannon's coming on, Deacon Fallon. Jack Schwager is going to be our end of year, by the way. That's all December. I mean, I can go through the rest of November, too. I mean, John Pugliano is going to be on. Kerry Lutz. Harry Dent is coming back. Scott Freeman. The list goes on. Thank you so much for joining me this week and every week, and I'll see you again real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.